Welcome to Chamber Talk with North Orange County Chamber. Our guest today is Senator Tom Omberg. He's a member of the California State Senate from the 34th District, which encompasses parts of North Orange County and a portion of Long Beach. Previously, politically, the Senator served in the California State Assembly, representing the 69th District, that's correct. Tom and his wife Robin have three children, Brett, Tommy and Erin. Tommy and Erin have followed in the Senator's footsteps, I believe, to be attorneys as well, is that right?
That's right. They're a little smarter than I am. They practice in a different area, but yes.
That's smart. Yeah, that's okay. Right. They learned from Dad. Right. That's the job. And other than that, it's great to see you again, Tom. Thank you so very much for coming here today. And I'd also like to say thank you very much for your service to both the country and the community. So thank you for being here today.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for including me. And thank you for the wonderful work that you've done with the business community and our economic development in this part of the county.
Thank you. So I'm going to start with an easy question, because what we like to do on this podcast is allow our listeners to learn a little bit more about who we're interviewing. So I know you were born in Cincinnati, is that right?
I was born in the Midwest and grew up in the Midwest, that's right.
All right. Yeah. And if you could tell us a little bit about that would be pretty nice as well.
Oh, sure. As you mentioned, I was born in Cincinnati. Our family moved to Northern Illinois, a very small town in Northern Illinois. And when I was in high school, my aspiration was to get out of that small town. And my ticket out was an Army scholarship. Wow. That's what brought me to California. And that was a pivotal moment. And just coincidentally, and it was just a coincidence, my father then took a job in Southern California and brought my four siblings out here to California. And so we were fortunate to La Habra, as a matter of fact, 1975. And so for quite a long time, all of us lived in around Southern California. And I then graduated from UCLA and went off to the Army and then to law school. And again, I guess, as they say, the rest is history.
So you graduated with honors from UCLA, as my wife would say, go Bruins. And then obviously you were on an Army scholarship. So you share a little bit about what the experience was there and what happened with that?
Sure. And I should mention that when I was in high school, the Army was just a ticket out of that small town in Illinois. I really didn't think much ahead, and I actually didn't have much interest in going to the Army. I had an interest in going to college, and that was a family of very modest means. And I was the oldest, family of five, and that was my ticket. That was my ticket to be able to go to college. And to be frank, I wasn't that excited about going to the Army. And I was in for a short period, then I went to law school and went back in the Army. And then I suppose it sort of grew on me. And fortunately, I met my wife on our way to Korea. And, you know, we were stationed in Korea. I was near the demilitarized zone. She was in Seoul. And then we were transferred to Europe. Then came back to the United States, came back to California. And then I got recalled a couple times. She got recalled. And here we are.
It's strange, isn't it? I was talking to Senator Josh Newman, who you know very well, not so long ago, and he was actually stationed in Korea too for a little term in his time. But obviously, you were different years when he was there later on. You were there earlier.
Yes. I'm a little older than Senator Newman.
Just a little. You don't look too much older, though.
Well, that's very nice of you to say. Andrew, I think you and I, you served in Europe too. You served in Germany.
Yeah, I did. Yes.
In a very elite unit, as I know.
Yeah, that's true. It's enjoyable.
It is. You know, it's interesting that military service, as I said, I wasn't that keen on going to the military, but I guess it sort of stuck and grew on me, it is transformational.
It is.
And I don't know if it was transformational in your life, but it was certainly in terms of what happened subsequently, there was no sort of more pivotal moment than actually taking that scholarship and sort of traveling down that road.
I think it really sets a lot of people up for life. Like the things you learn when you join the military and you take with you afterwards, you might not realize it at the time. Well, you would do because you're on a different level there. But as a soldier, you don't maybe realize all the things that you're being trained or what have you might make a big difference in your life. But as you go through life, certainly, without a doubt, you carry that with you, I think.
No, I think you do carry it with you. And that life experience where you serve with folks from all sorts of ethnicities, geographic regions, points of view, and you serve a mission bigger than you.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand, you know, what teamwork is about. You understand what dedicating yourself to a cause bigger than yourself and how fulfilling it is. It's transformational. And for a lot of the young people that I represent, it is an opportunity. It's an opportunity to, for example, go to college. It's an opportunity to travel the world. It's an opportunity to grow, as we just discussed.
And so, you know, furthering from your military career, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you're still part of the reserve unit, is
well,
it?
Well, I'm retired.
Oh, you're retired now. Okay, so retired colonel.
I'm retired. I was once retired and got recalled. So,
okay.
But that... that's not possible now. So both my wife and I are retired.
Now, during your time throughout the military, obviously you've been decorated with a lot of decorations, Bronze Star, Meritorious Service Medal, Coast Guard Distinguished Public Service Award, and so on and so forth. What was your involvement? I know a big part of it was your involvement was with global terrorism after 9/11. Would you like to share a little bit about, you know, why you came back in, what you were doing with that part?
Well, I came back in because they ordered me to come back in.
Oh, okay. Congratulations.
I was commissioned officer, and I never resigned my commission. I stayed in the reserve, and I guess technically, even when you're retired, you're still in the reserve of some sort. I was recalled a couple different times, once to serve as a military prosecutor concerning those who are alleged to have committed war crimes. They were then and still are housed at Guantanamo. Not the detainees, there's sort of a distinction between those who were charged with war crimes mm-hmm. and those who were simply detained.
Okay.
And so I was recalled to do that, and then I came back again and was recalled for service in Afghanistan. I had spent time in the Clinton administration focused on corruption issues. I was with the Drug Policy Office, corruption issues, mostly in Latin America. So I had some experience there. And then I went in Afghanistan. I was the first chief of anti-corruption to focus on the Afghan army and national police. And that was my role there. Very, very challenging. Very, very challenging.
So we see a lot on TV, explodes everything, doesn't it? So when you're talking about drug policies and things like that, you know, we see a lot of it's to do with like things like the CIA, but we don't really realize that you actually do have technical advisors like yourself from the military involved with these things as well.
No, that's right. Military played and still plays a major role, particularly in dealing with, as you said, intelligence, gathering intelligence and on the supply side of the equation, there are a number of different tools to deal with drug issues, and one is try to limit the supply. So to the extent that drugs are being manufactured and imported into the United States, or even manufactured in the United States, the military overseas works closely with DEA, Drug Enforcement Administration, with the CIA, and with the FBI. Yeah.
Now we're gonna move into politics in a moment, but as we're on this topic, I'm assuming you have a little bit more of, let's say, I don't mean higher intelligence, but let's say a lot more intelligence on things like the problem we're having with fentanyl right now, would you?
So you're right. Back in the day, I had a, you know, top secret, what's called a top secret SCI clearance. Today, I'm dealing with issues in the state Senate
sure.
of more of a policy nature versus an operational nature. And yes, I mean, I've been involved in the, I joke sometimes saying I've been doing drugs for many, many years. then I have to explain that that I was a federal prosecutor earlier in my career, and so in that capacity, in the capacity as a legislator, and I served on boards that deal with drug issues, and so I have spent a lot of my life focused upon it, not just on the sort of law enforcement side, but also on the prevention side, mm-hmm. which is critical. Important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you briefly mentioned a moment ago that you'd met your wife as you joined the military, and you were going to Korea, and then you were stationed in Europe together. You want to share a little bit about, because your wife's had an extensive military career too,
My
right?
wife's had even a more extensive career than I have. Yes, that's right. We met on our way to Korea. We served in Korea together. It's great good fortune of my life, but I think you may have mentioned, or at least you've read, that she actually outranks me. That our entire career, she's always been one rank above me.
Oh, your whole career?
Yeah, my whole career. Wow. Yeah. It's really sad. And, just like you, Andrew. I know Jennifer outranks you.
Everybody outranks their husband.
Jennifer, but,
yeah, that's
you know,
true.
And you served in the military. So, you know, there's this inherent bias in the military, and that's the only reason she outranked me. And here's what the bias is. You probably know that. The military favors those who are smarter and better leaders. And the only reason she outranked me is because she was smarter and a better leader. but she quite enjoyed the fact that she outranked me. She quite enjoyed, you know, this tradition. The military, the tradition is that the junior person has to
salute every morning.
Raise their hand in a hand salute. The Brits do a little more.
Yeah, that's right.
With a broader hand than the Americans.
Yeah.
And then they have to maintain that salute until the senior person returns it.
Mm-hmm.
So my
that
wife,
happens sometimes.
She when she was being promoted to lieutenant colonel, her father, a hero of World War II, Korea and Vietnam, pinned on one side, and I pinned on the other. She turned to me with 200 soldiers watching, and she let me stand there with my hand raised to my forehead, and I thought, she's just not cognizant of the protocol. And I whisper, hey, Robin, you got to return my salute. She says, for the entire group to hear, I'm just savoring the moment. So she let me stay. It was like an hour and a half, I think. She has served in many capacities, and I'm very, very fortunate that her mission in life is to serve veterans today.
That's good.
She's on the board of the California Veterans Board, and she's, you know, was Undersecretary of Veterans Affairs, and so, you know, being an old veteran, I'm lucky that's what she's devoted her life to.
Now she's helping you out. That's awesome. That's good. I appreciate you sharing a little bit about yourself there personally, because it's, you know, it's important to us all to understand who's actually out there fighting for us in the first place. So I really do appreciate that. And I'd like to switch a little bit towards politics, if I may, because, you know, that's another big part of your life. So before you becoming state senate, you were in the assembly. There's a lot of differences between being on assembly and senate, and of course a lot of us don't know that. You mind sharing a few of the main differences between the two?
I was first elected in 1990, so yes, there's great difference between those two bodies, but there's a huge difference between what life was like
then
in the legislature and now. I mean, then we were almost evenly divided. In fact, at one point, I'm a Democrat, the Republicans had the majority in the assembly. That's not true today. Democrats have an overwhelming majority in both houses. The assembly, there's 80 folks in the assembly, there's 40 in the Senate. The assembly is a little more rough and tumble than the Senate. You know, one of the key features of the Senate, and people have the sense that we're each other's throats all the time, you know, and there is greater polarization in the body politic today than there was before. But since there's only 40 members of the state Senate, is that we literally sit together for many hours in session, unlike the House of Representatives. We actually sit in our chamber for many hours, and we interact. There's only 40 of us, so we interact with each other all the time. We know each other's, you know, spouses and their kids and stuff. And so as a consequence, I think that we're much more civil with one another. There are, you know, very few personal attacks. Again, unlike the House of Representatives, because, you know, you're going to see that if you say something insulting to somebody, you're going to sit next to them that afternoon in a committee hearing.
Right.
And I think that that's obviously better for better for the process, mm-hmm. that we're focused on policy. Now, we do have some great policy differences, mm-hmm. some great policy differences, but personal animus doesn't enter into the equation, which is good. When the difference also is that, again, as I mentioned, the assembly was nearly evenly divided when I was in it. Now the Democrats have overwhelmed in the House where I sit. There's 32 Democrats and 8 Republicans. So it's a very different political equation.
And for the listeners out there, obviously, if you want to know more about the senator, if you visit their website, sd34.senate.ca.gov, and if you scroll down the landing page there, you'll be able to click on the legislation little icon there, and you'll be able to see the list that I've actually got here that the senator's actually done throughout his time. And some of these things obviously have passed, some have not. However, when we're looking at these, there's an awful lot of, you know, state senate bills or assembly bills that you've been involved with. Are there any here, regardless of the outcome, that stick more in your mind over others over the time?
Well, Andrew, you mentioned our website and list of legislation, and if you're an insomniac, I recommend that you go to that page and read all those pieces of legislation. But, you know, going way back in time, when I was a federal prosecutor, I prosecuted a fairly notorious hate crime where some skinheads tried to drive an African-American family out of their home in Westminster many years ago. And so when I went to the assembly, that was before hate crimes were even on the books. Right. I introduced a hate crime legislation where if you are targeting someone because of their race in particular, or other attributes as well, that is a different kind of harm, because that's a harm directed at a whole group of people, mm-hmm. as well as the individuals. So I did that. I was involved in legislation saying you got to keep, if you fired weapons, that if you have a weapon that you need to be able to know how to operate it. You need to know how to clean it. You need to know how to store it safely. You need to keep it away from young children. So that was long ago. And then recently, in terms of my background is in public safety, we've been focused on a couple different areas, fentanyl in particular, as well as retail theft. And those are two issues where we've been working. It's been frustrating in some respects, but I think those are two areas that need immediate attention for different reasons, but need immediate attention.
What would... If you would like to elaborate on both the fentanyl, sure. and the, why not, you know?
Let me. I can talk about fentanyl. Fentanyl now is a crisis. Fentanyl is very different than the other kinds of drugs we've seen in the past. For a variety of reasons. One, it's cheap. It's very inexpensive to buy. Number two, it's easily disguised. So fentanyl, you can buy Xanax, you can buy Percocet, you can buy oxycodone, and now it's often laced with fentanyl, and just a little bit of fentanyl, a very small amount, can kill you. Mm-hmm. So you may not even know, and often you don't know, that you're buying oxycodone or you're buying, you know, Xanax to calm your nerves, and it's laced with fentanyl, and you die. And point of fact, we have a bill called Alexandra's Law, and that's why it's called Alexandra's Law, because a young woman, very young woman, I believe 20 years old, Alexandra, she thought she was, you know, just taking an oxycodone, and oxycodone was laced with fentanyl, and within 12 hours she was dead. It's the number one killer of young people today, and so we need to deal with that comprehensively, both prevention's critically, if we're doing anything in terms of drug mm-hmm. issues, prevention is most important. Treatment, most important. Harm reduction, so if someone is overdosing so they don't die, most important. But also, one of the areas I focused upon is if you're a dealer of fentanyl, that we don't want you to deal fentanyl. We don't want you to deal fentanyl. So if you deal fentanyl and you're convicted of, for example, distributing fentanyl, and you do it again, and the person to whom you distribute dies, then just like in drunk driving, you're warned, don't do it. If you do it, you should know it's dangerous. You could be charged with a crime up to including homicide. That bill has had a rough go in the legislature. I'm reintroducing it again this year because I think it's a preventative measure. It's preventative because the judge says, let me back up, just like in drunk driving. If you're convicted of driving under the influence, judge says, hey, you've been convicted of driving under the influence. You should know that's very dangerous. It's a very dangerous activity to drive while you are intoxicated. And I'm warning you and letting you know if you do it again, you could be charged with a homicide. Same thing with fentanyl. Judge says, under at least my proposal, judge says, look it, you may not have known that you were dealing fentanyl. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't, but you did.
Right.
And so now you know if you sell, you know, Xanax again and it's laced with fentanyl and somebody dies, that you could be charged with a homicide. I'm warning you. And so it's a preventative measure.
So does that mean, so what you're talking about there, sorry for interrupting there, because it's quite a good conversation. Yeah. So does that mean you're talking, you're not just talking necessarily about drug dealers, you're talking about anybody who's actually selling maybe Oxycodone, or is it more to do with people who are selling?
Right. No, it deals with...
So like so, you have a responsibility of finding out the source of where it's coming from.
Andrew, you are exactly correct.
Makes sense to me.
If you are selling people a substance that you know is an opioid or methamphetamine or something like that, then and it contains fentanyl, you should know. You should know.
Well, that makes
sense. You shouldn't do it in the first place.
Well, no, that's true. You shouldn't be selling it anyway, but you should have figured out, done your homework, research, and seen who's got that in there.
Right.
Okay, well, that makes sense to me. Right. The other thing you mentioned there was there's a big part of, you know, stopping it in the first place, which is different than setting laws in a way. What type of things are you doing to prevent that? Yeah.
So,
I've had
a number of different jobs in my life, and one of the jobs I was the deputy drug czar, and there was a guy named General McCaffrey who was the drug czar at the time, and he said the most effective thing that can be done in terms of drug abuse is a conversation at the kitchen table between an adult who the child respects and that young person to talk about the dangers of drug use. It's not just say no, but to have a factual conversation about drugs. Fentanyl's a really good example about a conversation about how you might be taking fentanyl and not know it. And in California, we're promulgating information that discusses this, but it needs to be done even more so in schools, in any youth group, anytime. We need to spread that information that the expression is one pill can kill. That's absolutely correct. And we need to, for example, if someone has a substance abuse issue, is we need to attack it quickly with treatment. And I used to believe that only treatment that was voluntary was worthwhile pursuing. I don't believe that anymore. I think that if, for example, you are incarcerated and you have a drug issue, that we should put you in treatment. It's not as effective if it's not voluntary, but it takes sometimes. And so that's another important component of dealing with the, right now it's an epidemic concerning fentanyl.
So the other part that you mentioned was about the retail theft, which you see everywhere in the news right now. You want to share a little bit about what's going on with that?
So, and actually there's a relationship between retail theft and drug use.
And drug use,
That they're, you know, when I was a prosecutor, one of the federal crimes is bank robbery, and there was probably an 80% correlation between someone who had a substance abuse issue and robbing a bank.
Right.
And there's a strong correlation between, for example, shoplifting and substance abuse. So one of the things that we have discovered in the last 20 plus years is that the most effective time to intervene in someone's life if they're, for example, shoplifting or they have a substance abuse issue is early on. And historically, if you were a shoplifter and you stole, you know, fill in the blank, $200, you would be told, you know, you can face a punishment or you can go to drug court. And in drug courts can be very rigorous. You get drug tested. If you're a shoplifter and you have a substance abuse problem, very rigorous. You get drug tested, you know, very often. You have to make progress in terms of a high school diploma or some other degree. You have to go get a job, that kind of thing. But now the sanctions are very different, and so there's far less incentive for folks to go to drug court because there's not much of a sanction.
Okay.
And so I am interested in reforming the law so that we have greater incentives for people. I keep referring to young people. It's most often young people to actually go to drug courts. And the modification of a proposition passed a few years ago is to so right now, if you steal less than $950, it's in some jurisdictions in California, there's zero consequence.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite true in Orange County, but in some jurisdictions, there is zero consequence. To make sure that there's an incentive, there's a consequence to you if you decide you're going to steal and not, for example, go to drug court or something else. And then an inducement. If you do go to drug court and you successfully complete it, you don't have a criminal record.
The incentive
is to not have a criminal record. Having a criminal record is a challenge, employment and mm-hmm. housing, renting an apartment, all those things. And some places in the country have been very successful. And when people stay clean, that it's hard. I mean, mm-hmm. it's very hard when you've got an addiction to whatever substance. Besides the incentive to not have a criminal record, it was also when you test clean, you get another reward when you test clean to keep you from using drugs for a period of enough time that you are fully in recovery. So. That's what we need to do in retail theft. We need to increase the incentives to go to drug court or to go to the other kinds of courts, and we need to increase the disincentive, because there will be a punishment if you steal.
So I'm very oblivious to all this. So with that being said, does that mean somebody who got caught shoplifting, let's say, they actually have a choice of which type of court they go to, or...?
Historically, if for example, I keep using shoplifting, but it's not the only crime.
Sure.
So, but if you were caught shoplifting, say a couple hundred dollars, the judge would say, "Look, it, young person, you need to be in diversion, and we're going to try to divert you, or we're going to. If you've got a substance abuse problem, you need to fix that substance mm-hmm. abuse problem." So. I'm going to give you an opportunity to be diverted. Now, you have to successfully complete that program. You've got to do all these things that mm-hmm. we require, drug testing, advancement in terms of your life.
Right.
And if you don't want to do that, then what we're going to do is we're going to punish you in some fashion.
Okay.
Incarceration, fine, those kinds of things. And, oh, by the way, you're going to have a criminal conviction. And so that's going to follow you around.
So it's an opportunity for some folks.
Right. You can't force someone mm-hmm. to take advantage of that, but you can create the structure that highly incentivizes someone to do it, to get their life together. And, this is not great, great revelation that if you are shoplifting and you have a substance abuse problem, that gets worse. You're going to shoplift more and more and more. And sadly, you're also killing yourself and likely to commit even more egregious crimes, mm-hmm. crimes of violence, other serious crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to stop it early on. Mm-hmm. We need to intervene very early on, and we need to create the tools for judges and for prosecutors to be able to incentivize folks to deal with their issue very early on. So.
I'm sure it sort of runs into each other, and I totally forgot the name of the program that they were setting here in Orange County, but Supervisor Doug Chafee uh-huh. spoke about it, and it was a special court that they were wanting to push forward, weren't they? Is this part of that incentive or program? Or
yes, there are a number of special courts, and kudos to Orange County. Orange County, what I call collaborative courts, others call them collaborative courts, has done a good job. Judge Scott Cooper has done a very good job. The presiding judge, Judge Maria Hernandez, has been a strong supporter of it. We've done better here than most other counties in the state. I don't know if that was what Supervisor Chafee was talking about. He might have been talking about care court.
I think it was care court. That's what he was where he's helping people to rehabilitate and then get away from having those records?
At the behest of the governor, I carried, along with Senator Eggman, the care court legislation. Care court legislation is a little bit different than some of the other courts because it's not in the criminal realm, it's in the civil realm. And the consequence in the criminal realm is if you don't complete the program is potential jail. Consequence in the civil realm with care court, which is focused on schizophrenics or those that have schizophrenia-like conditions, is conservatorship. And a conservatorship is where basically you lose the ability to make decisions mm-hmm. for yourself mm-hmm. in almost every facet of life. Not something you want to have.
Right.
But care court, obviously I like it because I was the author. We're just starting it here in Orange County. And the focus is on having accountability for treatment, having accountability, both the system, holding the system accountable and the individual accountable, and a judge who has the power to do that. One of the challenges is that we have not had accountability in dealing with homelessness. We've not had accountability in dealing with, you know, some of these mental health disorders. And so the purpose of care court is to put somebody in charge who holds others accountable and is accountable themselves. Mm-hmm. One of the myths about schizophrenia or certain mental conditions is that once you're schizophrenic, that basically you're no longer going to be a productive citizen. That's not true. You're put in the right environment. You're given medication. You have a place to live. You actually can become a productive citizen.
Right.
And that's what care court is designed to do, is to take folks who are primarily homeless and schizophrenic and get them back on their feet so they can become productive taxpaying citizens.
Well, it sounds like a good a good job, doesn't it?
We're working on it. Yes.
So one of the things you mentioned early on there when you were talking about pushing through certain bills for like for the fentanyl and what have you, you said, you know, you deal with a lot of objections or obstacles. You want to share about what the type of obstacles you face when you're trying to do something like that?
So I'll use the two examples of one, care court, and the other, the fentanyl issue.
Sure.
On the fentanyl issue, the concern is that by some members of the legislature is that you are going to over-incarcerate people who are disproportionately incarcerated today, that you're mm-hmm. going to focus on people of color and that you're going to increase the numbers of people of color who are incarcerated. I disagree with that point of view. I don't think that this is, I think this is sort of not focused on, perpetrators are not disproportionately people of color. The perpetrators are,
whoever's,
you know, folks
breaking the law.
Well, and, you know, equal number of non persons of color is, or not equal number, more prevalent. And so folks are concerned about that, and so they've objected to the bill. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why it's failed. I'm trying to overcome that obstacle. On the care court side is that the objection, there are many objections, and some we need to deal with. You know, one of the objections is that we created a system where we don't have the resources to deal with those who are schizophrenic. So while you have a system, you don't have the housing or you don't have behavioral health professionals to be able to deal with it. And those are very legitimate concerns. So a judge says, I'm going to order basically the county to provide housing. The county says, we don't have any housing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we need to help. There's a proposition on the ballot to help deal with that. So yes, that's a legitimate concern. The other is we don't have the behavioral health professionals to be able to support, you know, the care court. And that's another legitimate concern that needs to be dealt with. There are other concerns that by the ACLU that by putting folks in care court, we are somehow depriving them of their free will. I disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I disagree with that. What we're doing is we're providing the structure for people to get better. If they absolutely refuse, then they'll go into conservatorship. But another myth is that you can have schizophrenia and you can have periods where you're medicated or sometimes even unmedicated and you're completely lucid, you have all your faculties and you can make rational decisions. So you can make a rational decision. I can say, hey, look, here's the thing, is that I want folks to administer these medications to me when I am you know, having a psychotic episode.
Right.
And I have now, I'm exercising my free will to tell you that if I am standing, you know, in the middle of the street, naked, yelling at a stoplight, you know, you should administer these medications to me. Right. So you've made that decision.
Yeah.
But the argument is that you lose that free will. I don't agree with that argument. I do recognize that there the legitimate concerns concerning housing for stabilization and behavioral health professionals. So.
Now some of these issues, you know, obviously you're dealing with it as a state level because you know it's a problem we have in the state. But then it overspills. It's in a lot of different states. Does any of this ever sort of then go up to the federal level and you're sort of working figure it out as a whole, like we're all in it together type deal?
So, Andrew, you're right. I mean, fentanyl is not just a California-centric issue. Prevention, not just a California-centric issue. There's the office I used to, where I was the deputy, was the Office of National Drug Control Policy. And they have some excellent products and excellent sort of best practices in terms of prevention. Criminal justice is largely a state and local issue, though. On the law enforcement side, that's largely state and local. And so while the federal government has some very sophisticated investigations as to large-scale fentanyl dealers, is that the federal government's not involved in treatment, really. I mean, there are exceptions to that. Federal government may provide resources. Federal government is not, in large part, involved in classroom instruction. And so we are complementary, but really the burden falls on us,
right,
in California. It falls on us in the legislature and local government to address prevention, treatment, rehabilitation, and law enforcement.
And saying that, because, you know, it's almost like, in my eyes, it's almost like we're in America, and then all the different states is almost like branched off to look after their own. Because, again, it's widespread, do you end up working alongside then colleagues who are from Florida or from Texas or from other states, and therefore you might think, well, this is a good idea, let's hone it over here. Does that happen too?
That's another great question. Yes, we do. We good ideas that work in our sister states need to be certainly considered here. I, until very recently, was on the board of the organization is now called All Rise, which is focused, I mentioned the collaborative courts, it's focused on the development, training, and the collection of best practices. It's a national organization funded in large part by the federal Department of Justice, and that's exactly what the purpose is. The purpose is to collect best practices, collect information, train people, be able to learn from other states' experiences, and I've carried bills. One comes to mind exactly based on Pennsylvania's experience with if you are in a treatment facility, you have certain rights, and the law says you have certain rights. You have a right to know basically what the treatment's about. Your relatives, if you consent, have a right to know, you know, how your treatment's progressing. You have a right to know about costs. You have a right to know about success rates. You have a right to know some of these things. We have a real problem with the proliferation of some of the rehabilitation facilities that are not operating in the best interests of their patients, but in their own pecuniary best interests.
That's good to hear. Yeah. I mean, it's right. Nice to be able to, because we don't often hear about this in our daily day, that folks are actually working together across the country to figure these situations out. So it's good to hear that. Thank you for sharing.
I have a colleague in Florida who Palm Beach who is sort of the expert in dealing with these sort of fraudulent rehab facilities, and we've learned a lot from them and him.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. So that sort of leads us into this other question: is, you know, a lot of senators and assembly men and women, they're on all these different committees, and you yourself, I know for a fact you're on quite a few committees, and you also chair the committees. What sort of impact do these committees have in our lives, I suppose?
Well, I like to think quite a bit. The committees what are called the standing committees, which are the committees that actually consider legislation and vote on them. I chair the Judiciary Committee. Judiciary Committee has the broadest policy purview of probably any committee in the Senate. Mm. We deal with social media, we deal with privacy, we deal with landlord-tenant, we deal with the operation of courts, we deal with the state bar. We deal with a whole bunch of issues that have sort of exploded over the years, particularly privacy and social media. Mm. We're considering legislation concerning restrictions on social media for children right now. We're considering legislation concerning how we're going to support credible journalism right now. As you know, our newspapers are imploding. What does that mean? How do we support it? Right now, people get most of their news from the internet. Do the platforms have a responsibility to support when they display content, but they don't really pay for it? Do they have a responsibility to provide some sort of compensation? That issue, landlord-tenant, the fact that we're just emerging, or COVID is still with us, but the peaks have gone, but people are still being evicted from their places of living. So what do we do with that? I spend a lot of time, as my staff will attest, a lot of time dealing with issues in judiciary, access to the courts, whether you can be able to testify or whether you can make a court appearance remotely, or do you have to go to court for a 5-minute appearance. Those are all things we're dealing with in judiciary committee. My goal is to reduce the cost of litigation and to provide greater access to the average person to justice. You know, family law is a great example. Most people aren't involved in multi-billion-dollar litigation, but a lot of people are involved in family law issues. Mm-hmm. You know, so being able to appear, so you don't have to miss a day of work, so you can appear remotely in family law, really important to me. So accessing justice so that we can provide the greatest access to justice, that's judiciary. Transportation, there's no one who lives in Southern California that doesn't face transportation challenges. And Andrew, let me tell you what one of the great frustrations is when you're stuck in traffic and you're looking around, you're going, boy, somebody should do something about this horrible traffic. And you go, oh yeah, it's me. That's a bit depressing sometimes. We've just opened the 405 here.
After the terrible fire on the bridge there.
We've got the express lanes, but my district office sits at the Santa Ana train station. It has, Metrolink and the Surfrider and other Amtrak chain trains and buses that come there. So that's transportation is one of the things that deeply affects the quality of life in Southern California. I sit on housing, another top issue, probably the issue foremost in the minds of folks in Orange County is the cost of housing and the challenge of homelessness. And that's housing committee and vets. Of course, I am a vet. I love the Veterans Committee. My wife, gives me lots of good ideas all the time. And that's, sort of a personal passion. So, yes, I think that the things that we do on those committees do have an impact on what Californians do, can afford, and, some of their quality of life issues,
And I'm assuming you consume an awful lot of one's time because there's so much you need to research, look into, hear about. Is there anything that, business members, chamber members, people who listen to this podcast could actually do to assist you or your office in this journey?
Yeah, another good question. Yes, they can. They can. I meet with folks in the business community all the time.
Yes.
One of the things that we want to do is there are some things that are important for the quality of life. There are other things that evolve and just create additional hassle for business, permitting issues, that kinds of things. So I have my own business, but people in the business community giving me a heads up that this is simply doesn't improve our standards, doesn't mean that we can't maintain California's environmental standard, but just the hassle of certain duplicative permits, that kind of thing. So calling our office, letting me know, visiting with me, letting me know, writing me, letting me know. I am more than blessed with a very, very, very good staff. They're my eyes and ears here in Orange County. Both here in the county, Anna Gonzalez is the district director, and my entire staff does an excellent job letting us know here in the county what local issues are impacting. And I've got a great staff in Sacramento as well, and I have a third staff. I chair the Judiciary Committee with very talented lawyers. And just keeping us informed, that's really important.
Well, that's good. That's good to know that they can just get hold of the office and share their information. Right. That's awesome. Right. So as we're going into wrapping up this podcast, and you know, you're one of those folks who you hear there and everywhere because you have to, it's part of another part of your job. And as we're delving into a very serious political year this year, you know, have you got anything else that maybe we've missed or you would like to share with anyone regarding, well, especially going out and vote for sure, but you know.
Oh no, you can't complain if you don't vote. You
know,
if you don't register to vote, then
you've missed out.
You missed out. Yeah. And you know, you've basically forfeited your right to
complain.
I think no, there's one other thing that's really important, and this is true of all of the legislators, is that one of the most important things we do is we serve the community directly. In other words, when someone has an issue with Medi-Cal, someone has an issue with, you know, some city issue, the education, we at least can be an advocate for them, DMV, all those things. You call our district office. That's our job. Our job is to be advocates for the people that we represent. Senate districts are huge, well over 900,000 people. But that's the thing that you know, sort of inspires me, is being able to help people, not just on a macro basis, but also individually. And I'll go back to this. I'm blessed with a highly motivated staff, particularly here in the district. That's why they come to work, is to help individuals.
Yeah, we see them daily. Yeah. Good. Well, Senator, thank you so very much for
Andrew,
coming
thank
on today.
You so
really
much. Thank you for let me conclude by thanking you again for your leadership.
Oh, thank you very
you know,
much.
The North Orange County Chamber has done wonderful things, and I know you're a great advocate for your members, and I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Right. And thank you for listening to Chamber Talk. We invite you to join our email list by visiting nocchamber.com and selecting sign up for e-news on the front page. For more interviews, you can follow us at chambertalk.podbean.com. Thank you.